thanks to Thomas Hood, who's writing from East Lothian in Scotland. I listen to your station on a Sony 2001D with a whip aerial, he writes.
Cuddly Capital 539, an article about the early days of Capital Radio when it started on 557 kHz. In the broadcaster, it was the summer of 1973. Michael Bucht, the programme controller, would take the team of DJs, which included Dave Simmons, Roger Scott, Tommy Vance, Joan Shenton and Nicky Horn, to various studios in London to practice. It was here that Bucht, a stocky, bearded gentleman in his 30s, with an authoritarian air complemented with a voice to match, would generally shout at the DJs and attempt to knock them into shape, a shape that he desired. Capital somehow had to be different, and Bucht knew what he wanted. Wrong or right, he intended to get the station sounding the way he perceived it should, the emphasis being on the one-to-one presenter-to-listener contact, the intimate friend. This probably explains why the jocks weren't jocks. They were presenters. Pretentious, maybe, but there was, and still is, a preconceived image people have of jocks. This was not what Bucht wanted, and at Capital in 1973, the jocks were presenters. To some of the presenters, it was only rock and roll, but to Bucht and the Capital management team, Capital was not going to be simply a commercial radio station that pulled in the bucks and played the hits. It was going to be something more substantial, a service that would be respected by the community and set an example for commercial radio to come. High ideals, but no one seemed to think it was not possible. In the temporary accommodation, 30 or so staff spent the day milling around, half of them shuffling bits of paper and not really having a clue what they were supposed to be doing. Hours would be spent designing a piece of paper that would slip into insignificance under a desk to be forgotten. Days passed by timing records and ordering product as presenters talked about this new station that all London would be listening to. For them, the only positive part of the week was going to a studio where they would pretend to be on the radio and get beaten up by Bucht, who would criticise links, shout Segway, and praise the odd link of which he approved. Just weeks before going on air, the Piccadilly premises were vacated. Everyone was moved to the Euston Tower, which was still littered with builders, decorators, electricians and engineers. This was to be the biggest commercial radio station in the world, but in the summer of 1973 it was little more than a building site. The stone floor corridors, covered in plaster dust and brightly coloured offcuts from cables, led around the first floor of the tower to the half-finished studios, where engineers had their heads buried in ducts and trunking. In the sparse offices, people were moving in their belongings. They were still shuffling papers, although by this time they had become accomplished at the art and looked as if they were actually doing something. Meanwhile, desks were moved into a vast open-plan office overlooking the Euston Road, an office that became affectionately known as the Playpen. It was here that programming staff began putting together material for the very first programmes. And with just a few weeks to go, it was an exciting time. It was also unlike any other launch of an independent station. It had to be. After all, this was only the second commercial station in the country, LBC having gone on air just weeks before. The programming was ambitious, to say the least, with a drama department, talks, documentaries, live music sessions, classical concerts, and all sprinkled with names like Dirk Bogarde, who presented his personal choice of music each weekend. This involved him putting the links onto a cassette recorder and posting it to London, where it became a pile of grief for an engineer to piece it together with records. The quality was appalling. Richard Attenborough supplemented the sparse record collection in the library with records from home, predominantly music from shows and film soundtracks. And the two staff spent the day cataloguing the expanding collection. By the beginning of October, the dry runs had begun. The presenters sat in the master control room, the presenter's studio still being unfinished, pretending to be on air. Bucked sat on the floor in an adjacent studio, listening, notepad in hand. Dressed in a brown corduroy jacket, with unkempt curly hair, he sprawled on the floor, occasionally making notes, occasionally shouting. He knew what he wanted and intended to get there. He was controlling this circus, and everyone knew it. There was little room for discussion, for airing points of view. The news was on. The reader queued into a report that had been badly recorded off a telephone line. Buck's pencil scribbled violently. Later in the day, he pointed out that the only time I want to hear a effing report recorded off a telephone line is when you've got a recording of Nixon jumping from the 42nd floor shouting, "I did it." The reporter got the message. The dry runs were followed by more dry runs, and staff were now almost living at the Euston Tower. In the evening, someone would go to the Indian, and large pots of curry would appear in the room that eventually was to become the canteen. It was help yourself. By October the 16th, the building was still unfinished. But thankfully, these studios were. The great day arrived. There were those who stayed all night, and those that trooped in the early hours of the morning. The corridors, by this time, carpeted with temporary carpet squares. By 4 a.m, people were chattering away with excitement, while on 539 and 95.8, the IBA's tape of library music mercilessly churned on. By 5 a.m, it was replaced by the national anthem. There followed a second silence, and Richard Attenborough's voice informed the odd milkman and paperboy who had accidentally stumbled upon 539, "This, for the very first time, is Capital Radio." Blue Mink burst into song. "Isn't it good to know, Capital Radio? You can turn on a friend, you can turn on a show." The George Martin-produced jingle package segue into Bridge Over Troubled Water, and Capital Radio was born. In the music studio, the champagne corks popped, and the bubbly liquid was mixed with orange juice as the multi-million-pound project had at last ejaculated. In the Euston Tower, Dave Simmons' voice could be heard in every office, on every transistor, on every desk. London was listening for the very first time to Capital Radio, or everyone felt it was. The fact is, the event, to the vast majority of Londoners, passed unnoticed. And as the sun struggled up on that misty October morning, the vast majority of Londoners were listening to Noel Edmonds, as usual. But at Broadcasting House, they were listening, and later in the day asked for comment from the odd newspaper that showed interest. One cynic was quoted as saying, "Radio 1.5. But at that time, there was no benchmark for commercial radio at all. There were the American services, which were impossible to emulate due to the restrictions laid down by the IBA. So, Capital sounded like a BBC local station, laden with features, short drama, documentaries and interviews. The only real difference being there were commercials, a rather expensive jingle package, and station output littered with star names. As the first weeks passed, insecurity soon replaced euphoria. Staff spent time speculating, discussing the future, and criticising. As the day moved over to evening, groups of people gathered in various offices throughout the first floor of the Euston Tower and had a drink or two while discussing the station. Politics were raising their head, and it wasn't long before the friction began. On the morning show, which was presented by Tommy Vance and Joan Shenton, the happy couple, now having passed the honeymoon stage, were bitching. Not on air, but it was getting close. It was obviously becoming a struggle for Tommy Vance, who was more into rock and roll radio, to listen to Joan Shenton, a presenter who favoured items of reportage nature, to witter on about babies to a woman in Ealing who wanted to exchange her baby buggy for an electric toaster on the swap shop, a regular feature of the show. More about the beginnings of Capital Radio after this record. Continue with a piece about the beginnings of Capital Radio in 1973, Cuddly Capital 539 from the broadcaster. It was also becoming apparent that some of the staff hadn't a clue what they were doing. A fact that was beginning to show on the various weekend programmes, the majority of which were recorded and would underrun, overrun, or in one or two cases be transmitted unedited. It wasn't long before the odd F-word went to air. Sadly, the first one being one of the most prestigious talks programmes. Then came the changes. Roger Scott replaced Dave Simmons on Breakfast, Simmons filling the drive-time slot vacated by Scott. A then rather demure-sounding Roger Scott delivered Breakfast with the help of Monty Modlin, who spent his time out and about in London with a producer who spent all her time trying to get him to shut up and come out on time. He seldom did, and Scott on more than one occasion pulled the fader down on him. As the winter of 1973 began, there was concern. Outside the Euston Tower in the real world, there were petrol shortages, a three-day week, and power cuts. Edward Heath wasn't hitting it off with the unions, and it was a depressing time. In the tower, clandestine meetings were taking place. Senior staff hurried up and down corridors, to and from meetings conducted behind closed doors. There were also meetings held outside the building, an ominous sign of things going wrong. Capital Radio had not set the world alight. In fact, Capital Radio was boring. It lacked excitement and, more importantly, as a consequence, was not bringing in the advertising revenue. For people who wanted drama, there was Radio 4. For light entertainment, Radio 2. And pop provided by Radio 1. The Capital listener had to be someone who was manic to attempt to keep up with all the shots at different ill-fitting bits of programming. But these were early days, days bogged down with rules and regulations. Needle time was restricted, Live music sessions had to be recorded. There was an obligation to broadcast religion and drama. A far cry from today. Commercial radio was still obliged to give the listener what bureaucracy felt the listener wanted. But in a commercial environment, the listener has clout. No ratings, no advertising, no advertising, no radio station. Capital was attempting to be all things to all people and was becoming nothing to anyone. The staff were speculating as to what would be next. The pioneers had come into contact with the real world and the axe was to fall. The newsroom was first. Ron Onions, the head of news, along with the best part of the team, were paid off. It was becoming apparent that all London wanted was rock and roll. After all, rock and roll presented by people larger than life. It was all very well being a friend to the listener, but this friend was of the variety that you would go to great lengths to avoid at a party. By the end of the year, Capital had a new image, Cuddly Capital, with Kenny Everett and Dave Cash on The Breakfast Show. The station was effectively relaunched. Promotions were played literally every 20 minutes throughout the day for the Kenny Cash Breakfast Show, promotions that were made by Everett. Capital was sounding like Radio Kenny Everett, but it was beginning to work. People were beginning to sample the station. This, for many, was Capital Radio for the very first time. With Kenny Everett on The Breakfast Show, Dave Cash moved to lunchtime, and Michael Aspel on the morning programme. Capital Radio began to pull an audience. For the first time, the station was beginning to be heard in restaurants and shops around London. The music had also changed. Gone was the middle-of-the-road, polished-sounding format. Capital had a massive injection of glam rock and glitter. In the space of just months, the station had gone from a quality music first policy, with presenters second, to using upfront named presenters, interspersed with Gary Glitter and Mud. This lady was foreturning, but it was working. Slowly, drama disappeared, along with Monty Modlin, and the patchwork quilt of weekend talk and features programmes. Just the classical music programme, alternatives, the arts programme, and Mardi Gras remained in the coming years. Capital was at last beginning to work. Michael Aspel, after a sticky start adapting to self-operation, up to this point in his life he had always had a BBC technical operator, settled in and even managed to wean himself of the BBC headphones that were specially adapted because he was so used to them. By 1975, Capital was claiming an audience of 1.1 million each weekday. Kenny Everett's share of the available listeners was 8%, while Aspel achieved 12%. Both programmes attracted a slightly down-market audience. But by this time, Capital was becoming established. But the everyday routine of The Breakfast Show was beginning to bore Everett, who would present the programme and at the same time play patience with a pack of playing cards. And the morning arrived when he wasn't there. He attempted suicide. I woke up and was surrounded by all these people who were dressed in white, and I thought it was heaven. But I was in hospital, he was quoted as saying. Various replacements filled the hole while the problem was resolved. Eventually, when Graham Dean took over and remained on Breakfast throughout the 70s and into the 80s, during which time Capital continued to grow. And in spite of setbacks, none as monumental as the launch and subsequent relaunch in those early days, Capital today is the biggest commercial radio station in the world. Many of the staff from those early days of Capital have moved on. Sue Cook, who used to present the shopping basket on the Aspel programme, moved on to a career in television, as did Pam Armstrong, who also presented the same feature. Aspel himself moving on some years later. The list is endless, but there are few of the original staff who will recall those early days in Piccadilly. Kenny Everett, Dave Cash and Dave Simmons, who all rejoined the Gold Service. Peter Jackson, the chief engineer, Mike Childs, one of the senior producers, Peter Ockerford and a handful of others, all of whom will be able to recall the days of Capital 539, possibly with affection. They will also recall around 18 years ago, John Whitney, then managing director, arranged for a time capsule to be constructed and inserted into the wall of the reception area of Capitol. In it was placed trivia like parking tickets and a programme schedule. A photograph was taken of those present at the sealing ceremony. The capsule will be opened in 7 years. Roger Scott, sadly, is just one person who will not be at the opening. But in the meantime, the programme schedule looks like this. Capitol Radio programmes from Friday, November the 23rd, 1973. 6 o'clock in the morning. Music and Roger Scott. With news, weather checks, Monty Modlin and surprise packages. 9 a.m. Music with Tommy Vance and Joan Shenton with Swap Shop when listeners phone to swap goods. 10:05 a.m. She and Me, a 5-minute serial starring Lewis Maxwell and music. 10 a.m. Dapple Downs, a new serial with Adrian Corrie. Midday, music with Dave Cash and Cash Countdown, a phone-in competition for big prizes. At 2 p.m. on Capitol, it was music with Tony Myatt and the listener's talent spot. At 2:15, The Courtesans, a new historical serial, and at 4 p.m, The Bedsitter, starring Peggy Mount. 4:15 p.m, Dave Simmons with music and the latest travel and traffic news. At 5:55, Honey Adair, radio's first strip cartoon. Good grief. At 6 p.m, London's Day with Sue Denny and Simon Preble, summing up today and exploring tomorrow. 6:30 p.m, Your Mother Wouldn't Like It, Nicky Horn's rock show with Flatshare and special guests. And 8:30 p.m, Open Line with Alan Hargreaves, a phone-in for advice, argument and comment. Capitol's programmes, November 1973.
Oh,
of articles from Audio Media. If you thought you had some strange friends, well, have a listen to this. A recent film which can't have failed to come to your attention is Peter Greenaway's Prospero's Books, based on Shakespeare's play The Tempest, and starring John Gielgud as Prospero. If you haven't seen it yet, even if art movies are not to your taste, you owe it to yourself to experience the rich visual texture achieved with the aid of high-definition video techniques, which is just one of the delights the film has to offer. The sound on Prospero's books is interesting too, with much of the work on dialogue and sound effects having been done at Hackenbacher Studio. If you're thinking that the name sounds familiar but can't quite place its derivation, think of Gerry Anderson's Thunderbirds. Hiram H. Hackenbacher is none other than the bright chap with the big spectacles. Brains. Hackenbacher's involvement with Peter Greenaway started several years ago on The Belly of an Architect. On Prospero's books, Hackenbacher's role was in manipulating the dialogue, which is far from conventional in its presentation, and creating sound effects. For the latter, Nigel will either modify sound library effects or think of a weird and or wonderful way of producing something new. If we haven't got an effect, we go out and shoot it. But I think that if you haven't shot it yourself, I would bet a pound to a penny that you're going to have to manipulate it in some way to make it work. It's very rare that you can see something that is mute on the screen, make a list of what you need, go and get it from a library, and find that the effect works every time. I hate using library effects. If I needed a hand clap, I would much rather have a bloke go in the booth and clap his hands, rather than search through a library, which I think is a waste of time. Samplers are great for creating those noises. For the weirder Greenway-esque type of stuff, the Akai S1000 is magic. There is one noise that we used quite a bit. I ripped apart a Tandy PZM microphone and stuck it inside an old toaster, like you do. I just moved the toaster around and stuck the sound in the S1000, messed around with it, and made the most weird stereo ambience. That's the fun part. If you've got a microphone and a booth, you can make whatever noise you want. Prospero's books features some underwater sequences where I wanted to make a noise that sounded like whales, but not just using any old library whale sound. I wanted to make it sound like the whale was sitting right next to you, talking to you. The best way we found to do it was to get the sound of a gibbon, run it into the audio file, and use VariSpeed. Well, the article continues, but I think you get the picture. And another article in Audio Media, the recently released Poolside Drums CD gives sampler owners access to a huge selection of drum and percussion sounds, with a difference. They were recorded on location within the confines of a 1.5 million cubic foot capacity swimming pool. London Sample Workshop founder Tom McLaughlin and session drummer Neil Huxtable talk to Audio Media about sampling, swimming pools, and foam rubber. Well, the foam rubber first. Talking to Tom, it was a toss-up at school whether to pursue a career in music or puppets and sculpting, and I happened to win a full scholarship to study sculpture at art college. That solved that. I dropped out in the first year and started working for a marionette company making puppets for commercials, and never too far from recording, produced pre-recorded backing tapes for shows. A few years later, I was asked to work for the Muppets. I was really into latex. No, not the way you think. As a flexible casting material. Fascinated by it. Being in the right place at the right time, it turned out that Henson Associates was about to embark on a film project like no other, The Dark Crystal, that would rely on vast quantities of foam latex to realize its three-dimensional animatronic characters. I'd already been making Miss Piggy heads out of foam rubber for The Muppet Show when pre-production started on The Dark Crystal project, but relying on ready-made foam rubber kits left much to be desired, as did standard plaster moulds, which fell apart after several cure cycles. At that point, the mad scientist in me came to the forefront, and I proceeded to research and develop a new grade of latex foam, and moulding and casting techniques more suited to the puppets and beasties at hand, rather than the beds, car seats, and the odd makeup appliance previously manufactured from the material. My formulations and techniques are still in common use throughout the film industry. Jim Henson was an incredibly forward-thinking man, and gave all of his employees enough creative space to develop new materials and techniques. So onto the drum sampler. The advent of cheap DSP techniques 5 or 6 years ago made a lot of people think that live recording rooms would be an extinct species by now. Of course, that hasn't proved to be the case. A good live room is as popular as ever. Digital reverb isn't the be-all and end-all we thought it would become. I can't see the sense in recording samples with artificial ambience when everybody and their brother has a digital reverb of some sort or another at home. I knew that I wanted to do some big drums in a real acoustic space that was a little bit out of the ordinary. I'd toyed around in an automotive warehouse at night and also listened to a few other large industrial-type places. A mate of mine, Smarty, lives just around the corner from the Janet Agoke Leisure Centre, formerly the White City Swimming Baths. One day we were working on some reggae tracks at his place, and when he had to pick his daughter up from her swimming session, I trotted along. As soon as we were inside the building, I clapped my hands, and this huge smile crossed my face. It was at that moment I realised that this was the place. I'd love to record a heavy metal band there. There's this mezzanine that we immediately realised was the obvious place to record from. It's a balcony, roughly halfway between the surface of the pool and the ceiling, that just about comes out to the pool, so we were a good distance from the main walls of the building and about 8 feet above the water. Well, the article continues with more drum lunacy, and rounds up, the whole poolside drum project really turned me on to the idea of recording in genuine environments, as opposed to studios. Although we'll never rule out studio recordings, how about car parks, caves, or subways in the middle of the night? String quartets or early keyboard instruments in stately mansions. There are so many possibilities, and people aren't even scratching the surface. But the workshop is about much more than location recordings of drums. It's about bringing fresh, new, musically useful sounds to the sampling musician.